Good afternoon. Today is Tuesday, October 1st, and it's 1:30 p.m. This is Talk on the Rock, and I'm your host, Colette Czarnecki. The Nolan Center is about to be 20 years old, and in 2 weeks, they will hold a celebration. We're going to talk a little bit about that with Gig Decker, who is a Friends of the Museum board member. He's also going to share with us his experience deep sea diving around shipwrecks, including the Star of Bengal. You can call in to ask a question. The number to KSDK is 874-2345. Hi, Gig. How are you today?
I'm real good. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming in. So, could you give us a little bit of information on who you are? Like, how long have you been with the Friends of the Museum?
Okay. Well, I've been with the Friends of the Museum before the Nolan Center, back when the museum was in the basement of the old gym. And I was involved with Teresa Thibault, who was our director then, and she's now on the State Historic Board, which is a real adjunct for us, you know, to have a friend on that board. And so, yeah, I've been on here as long as I can remember.
That's awesome. Wow. Okay, so before the Nolan Center.
Mm-hmm.
And how long have you been in Wrangell for?
I came here in 1974 and fished one season gill netting, and then I went to the Bering Sea and fished Bristol Bay and worked on trawlers and king crab boats, and I liked it up there, but I always dreamed about Wrangell and Petersburg, and when I came back 10 years later, I was only in town 5 minutes. I walked around the bay and found a little house above the fish and game float that seemed like it was deserted, and got a hold of the gal who owned it and bought it. I've been here since 1983.
Yeah, that's amazing. Was it easy to just come across that luck buying a house back then?
There was a lot of pretty reasonable property here. Petersburg was just outrageously expensive, but Wrangell wasn't. And I knew I wanted to be in Wrangell because I had been here and had a lot of friends here. And it was just I was very impressed with how relaxed and friendly it was, and that's what I was looking for. I grew up in the North Seattle area, and I wanted to get away from that kind of mentality, and so I've loved it ever since.
Awesome. And so what else has preoccupied your time on this island here?
Well, you know, I've been a commercial fisherman for 51 years. I've never missed a year gill netting, and I've done a lot of different fisheries. About 35 years ago, I because I was a commercial harvest diver for 38 years, and I'd run across wrecks all the time, anything from sport boats to gill netters, trawlers, Navy ships. So I became interested in wrecks, and I've always been very fascinated by them. And I think the reason is because the same reason that I'm very fascinated and so involved in the museum is a wreck, just like a museum, is a chance for us to really be face to face with history. And it's one thing to be told about history or to read about it, but when you can actually look into a case and see something that is over 100 years old, or actually go out on a wreck and actually touch something where people had died in that wreck, it's a very moving experience.
Yes, I definitely was going to ask you about that. So when you are next to these wrecks, you know, like you said, you're face to face with history. What do you feel when you're, you know, underwater? And
well, it depends on the wreck, but in terms of any kind of wreck that is a burial site also has a certain feel to it that is very eerie and a little scary. And like the Star of Bengal, you know, had 110 of the 111 Asian cannery workers were killed on that. And a lot of those people are still in the wreck. Or their remains. And so it's it gives you an eerie feeling, and it's something that I think you have to have a lot of respect for being involved in that sort of thing. I've always been the type of person since I started getting involved in shipwrecks is I really stay away from people who collect things off of wrecks. And I don't associate with those kinds of divers or those kinds of people. And I make it really clear to people when I'm involved with wrecks that I'm just interested in any recovery for the museum or for historical development, that I'm really against pilfering wrecks, and especially a wreck like the Star Bengal that is a death site. People are actually buried there. That is very particular to me that not robbing grave sites. So it's very fascinating to me. I really get a kick out of it, and it's a, you know, anytime you find a wreck that you've been interested in, a historical wreck like the Bengal, and you finally go down the first time and actually see it and touch it, it's a big thrill for a person like me. And I'm very interested in history and culture, and you know, Wrangell is just incredible. I mean, 10,000 years of native seafaring. The Russians, the French, the English, Spanish. I mean, the fur trading, the gold movement, the fishing and logging. I mean, this place is really a treasure trove of history.
It's really interesting that you say, you know, you don't take anything from the wrecks, any relics or whatever, because I just read a story about like a shipwreck off of the coast of France where gold was deposited. How long do you stay underwater then when you're exploring?
Well, it depends. I have an oxygen generator on my compressor, and so I usually run 36% oxygen, which if you're that level of, we're breathing about 20% right now. And so that's just bringing it up to 36 is very common, for scuba divers. And if you are diving in less than 90 feet, you have unlimited time. You just come up and change your tanks. So extra oxygen actually does is it displaces nitrogen so that as you become more and more compressed when you go down, your body will store more nitrogen. And so when you come up, if you have too much in a bottle of pop, it'll start bubbling out and it'll get into your bloodstream and can cause problems. So with the extra oxygen, you're never taking on more nitrogen than your body can expel. So you can be down pretty unlimited. The problem with nitrox is that when you, if you get at 36%, if you get below 93 feet, it become you'll convulse on it. Not maybe convulse, you will convulse, and you can't save a convulsing diver. He will drown. So,
wow, how far deep is the Star of Bengal then?
The first third of it, it's about 276 feet, I think. So the first 100 feet is in about 70 feet of water, depending on the tide, and then it broke up on a reef, and the rest of it, I think, is deeper. And so down the road, one of the things that we're doing, we dove on it, the dive group that I've got going now, the group of us, we dove on it a year ago last spring. And so we're aware that the cabin, which is where it is in the back of the boat, which is in the deeper water, 140 feet or something like that, that's what'll have the strong box where all the valuables of the crew and everyone that was on board, all their valuables, all their money was in that box. And so that would be, historically for the museum, that would be a great thing to recover. But that's going to take a lot of planning. And this next group, we were supposed to be out there this week, but the weather was too bad, and so we didn't get to go, so we rescheduled for March. But one of the people in our crew, he has a business back in Canada where he does remote sensing, and so he created a grid for us to use to explore the wreck and the debris pile, and then we can run our ROVs and the divers, and when we find something, we can embed that in the charts that he makes. But he'll be creating a three-dimensional chart of that entire area. So it's, I don't know if you've ever seen on TV the draining the oceans, where you can look at wrecks and explore them, you know, without the confusion of the water. I mean, you know, these bottom mapping systems like the one that he has will create a three-dimensional picture of the shoreline, the wreck, debris, everything, all the way down to 3 centimeters.
Wow.
So that will be a huge adjunct for us when we start looking a little closer at the wreck.
Okay, and an ROV, you said ROV, that's pretty much a program. What is that?
No, ROV is a remote operated vehicle. We have a couple of those, and you have a screen on top, and you can drive it from on top, and it's got a video, and you can drive around and mark things.
Yeah, great, awesome. Thank you for that description. And just speaking of description, what do you see when you're underwater, like near these shipwrecks? Like, what's the color like? You know, what does it sound like?
Yeah. Not much sound, but you know, and it depends on the time of year. Like right now, there's still a lot of plankton in the water, so it won't be very good for photography. Because one thing about a wreck is that you need some depth of field. So when you're photographing the wrecks, it's hard to use lights because it'll show everything that's really close. And you need to have natural light to where you can see down into the wreck and you know, a further view of it. So the best time for a wreck diving on the coast here in Alaska, because we have such tremendous blooms of plankton, is, you know, December, January, February, March. And probably the very best times is January and February. And of course, it's cold and the weather is variable. So,
yeah. And just to give a recap about the Star of Bengal, it was leaving Wrangell and it was found, you know, it crashed. It was a shipwreck off of Coronation Island in, I believe, 1908, right?
Yeah.
And
September 20th.
Okay, September 20th. And they were carrying about 52,000 cases of Wrangell canned salmon, and they were heading back to San Francisco.
Yes, and the 111 Asian cannery crew, and then you know a few white cannery people, you know, officials, and they were being towed by 2 tugboats. The law was that because these big square rig sailing ships couldn't maneuver on inside waters very well, by law they had to be towed out to a line that connected all the outside islands so they could be out in the ocean and be able to use their square rig ships. And one of the steam-powered tugboats, the weather came up, flash. I mean, that's Coronation Island's famous for that. But the weather came up, and one of the tugboats became disabled, and so they had to let the Star Bengal in close to the beach and got them anchored up. And they are actually anchored up for 4 hours before they drug back and had to abandon the ship when it started breaking up on the rocks.
Wow. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And can you go in a little more about what inspired you to explore the shipwrecks?
Well, it, you know, being a commercial harvest diver, cucumbers and urchins and abalone, and you know, you run into a lot of wrecks, and I've always been involved in history. I've always loved history, especially local Alaska history, and you know, they're an artifact of our history. And my interest in history and museums goes back 65 years ago, when I was in about third grade. My parents took us on a vacation, and we always went to some interesting places. But this particular time, I mean, this is probably the first memory I have, and it's very significant. But we were in a several-story museum in Utah, and I got separated from my parents, and I ran into a glass case that had a young native person who had been mummified. And he looked like about my age. And so it was really kind of shocking to me and kind of like horrified me. And my father came up and we started talking about it. And he explained to me that every culture in the world, every peoples in the world try to make sense out of things like death. And they try to show their respect and their love for their ones that pass on by different kinds of rituals. And these native groups down in Utah, one of the ways that they did that was they mummified their loved ones. And after that experience, I thought about that a lot, and a light came on in my head that, oh my God, you know, these things are knowable, you know, and you know, being able to share in those cultural things, rituals, is a way for us to look at different aspects of our life and the different aspects of people's cultures and be able to think and learn about life. And it always stuck with me, and I've always had a love of museums and history, and it always goes back to that.
Yeah, I love that. That's amazing. Just you having that experience at the age of six, mm-hmm. and, you know, your father explaining about culture to you, too. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And so it's always stuck with you. And how did you end up joining Friends of the Museum?
Well, Volney Smith, Cliff James, and I were trying to find the Bengal unsuccessfully. And Volney and I were both pretty experienced harvest divers, so we had quite a bit of time underwater, and Cliff wanted to become a harvest diver, and so we traded him, training him and taking him out, for him applying for a nonprofit status for us, because we wanted to, our first goal was to find the Star Bengal and then register it with the Federal Registry to where it couldn't be pilfered. And so it was just a fun thing to do. And we were in Port Protection, and we ran into John and Litzy Bean, who are great, great people. And they were trollers, and they did a lot of beachcombing. And we were talking about the Bengal. And on the way back through his garden, we were going back to the boat, I seen a deadhead that was stuck in the top of his garden, and I knew exactly what it was. And I asked him, and I said, what is that? And he says, I don't know, but I found it on the beach north of China Cove, and right away I went, bingo. I mean, that's a huge deadhead. You know the deadheads? They're a block that's got three holes in it, and there's one on the rail and then one on the spars. And when you set these big square rig sailing ships, the sails are so heavy that they got to let them out, and then they tighten those with the two deadheads. So I knew that it was obviously off of a huge sailing ship, and there was only one that I know of. So we jumped in the boat and went right out there and went right to the spot and got to dive on it, found the chain and the anchor and the bow and the capstan. And so it was really, really exciting.
Oh, my goodness.
And that was about 35 years ago.
I was just going to ask. Yeah. And, okay, forgive me about my ignorance, but were you the first crew to...
We thought we were. We weren't. There was a couple of guys from Ketchikan that had found it and had dove on it. They hadn't, you know, I wasn't aware of them. And I never really did become aware of them until this group that I'm involved with that Ray Troll put together. Because, you know, Ray Troll and I were talking. He was saying, well, you know, when are you going to... You know, because I'm always talking about the Star of Bengal and shipwrecks and stuff. And he said, well, when are you going to develop this? You know, and I said, we need to have an underwater archaeologist. We need to have someone come out there. Nobody believes Gig Decker, the commercial fisherman, that he found this shipwreck of that magnitude. So we have to have that. And I said, we really have to have a guy that's got a bottom mapping system. Because there's pinnacle rocks there. If we really want to study the wreck, we have to have an underwater map of the bottom and the wreck. And so Ray is the one that put us all together. He's the one that knew Jinya Anachinko, who is a Russian underwater archaeologist, probably, she is the premier underwater archaeologist in Alaska and has done all the really cool sites, you know, all the way down to the Neva, in which is the oldest wreck in Alaska, in Sitka. And he knew Bill Urschel, who has the Endeavor, who's the boat that we use. And he's a nonprofit researcher that Rachel has spent a lot of time with. And then there's the Sean Adams, who's the guy that has a business in Canada of remote sensing. And he's got all kinds of underwater drones and above water drones. And, you know, just that's what he does. So he's been a very important part of it. And then he also knew a guy that went out with us the first time from the East Coast, Sean Dills, who was a professional researcher, historical researcher for the Forest Service, I think. And then the other person was Tessa Halls, who is a Chinese writer who from Seattle that was really interested in the Asian influence in the history. So it was a great group of people, really a fun group. I'm the only unprofessional guy, but it was fun to be with a group like that. And we're still together. And you know, like I said, you know, we're planning on studying that interests us. Is there's a lot of things I could talk about, but one of the things is there's a big question about why 110 of 111 Asian canyon workers died and most of the crew got off, mm-hmm. including the captain and the mate, which by law, they should have been the last people off the boat. And so during the prosecutions of Mates and Masters down in San Francisco, they stated, and the whole crew stated, that they'd opened the hold up to let the Chinese out because they always rode in the first hold. Because the ships would handle more volume than they could weight, you know. So 50,000 cases of salmon, it would only fill up the back two holds and maybe half the forward. And so it was very common for them to build their own apartments, you know, cook for themselves, everything in the forward hold, and it helped the ship ride better. Well, I believe that they locked them down there because when the ship started, you know, floundering, the 36 people on the deck didn't want to deal with 110 or 111 crazed Chinese, and so I think they left them there and they didn't let them out in time. I could talk for a long time about this whole thing. There, we have several letters from people that were on the one guy was on the crew, another the two people that were in the tugboats that confirm what I'm saying, but that wasn't stated when they went down.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Ronan Rudy he has a podcast on that. Well,
he's a part of our group now.
Oh my goodness.
Oh yeah. No, he's a riot. And he's a tremendous researcher. And he's been really excited to have you know, being a part of our group.
Yeah, yeah. And so we have about 7 minutes left, but so the 20th anniversary celebration at mm-hmm. the Nolan Center, mm-hmm. there's going to be an underwater archaeologist who's going to speak about this too, yeah. the Star of Bengal's shipwreck.
Yeah.
Can you say anything else about that?
Well, that's Jinya Anachinko, and she's a very interesting person, and she has a real firm commitment, as the whole group does. But Anachinko has a very firm commitment that when you do archaeological work like wrecks, it should be associated with the community that it's associated with. So in other words, both the Anchorage Museum and the Juneau Museum has expressed interest in any artifacts that we bring off the wreck. So we've made it very clear to them and to the Office of History and Archaeology, who controls what you can do on this wreck, that we want anything of any kind of historical thing that comes off the wreck, we want to come to the Rango Museum. Now, a diver just this last spring for the Department of Fisheries. He's a survey diver, was diving in that area and came across the wreck. And he found the bell. Now, to any shipwreck diver, the bell is the heart of the shipwreck. So it's a very, very important artifact that we want in the Rango Museum. So I extensively made the argument to everyone that was involved that we don't want that removed unless it comes to the Rango Museum. It's a very important artifact for that wreck. And so it's been agreed upon, because it has to be reclamated. I mean, you know, we don't have anyone who deals with metals. So it's, when we bring it up, we're going to have to encase it in seawater, and it's got to be sent up to Anchorage, and they're going to go ahead and you know, preserve it. And after the preservation of it, then it'll be permanently in the Rango Museum.
Wow.
So I'm pretty excited about that. Now, I wanted to, on that same note, I wanted to, you know, say that, you know, our whole group, I mean, you know, we enjoy this sort of thing, but our intention is to add to the history and the culture of Rango and the Rango Museum. We're very committed to that. And it's a great group. And the museum itself is so important to me and to us. And when you live in a place like Rango, it's like a two-way street. I mean, we can go in, we can look at stuff in the museum and enjoy that, but the museum also is out in the community, getting people to come forward, like Augie Schultz with his photographs are just fantastic. I mean, he had one of Sig Torgerson this morning on one of the boats that he worked on, and Sig was a really good friend of mine and a fascinating guy. Was an Aleut from the Aleutian Islands that got moved down here during the war, him and his brothers, three brothers. And I named my son after him because that's how much I liked him. And so Augie's got just tremendous amount of historical photos that are really fascinating. And that's something, that's a function that the museum has. It's a two-way street.
Yeah. Thank you for all of this fascinating history and information. It's super exciting. And what do you, does your group, diving group, have a name?
We're called UCHART. It's an acronym for a historical preservation diving group. So underwater archaeological preservation. And so...
Okay, I'm just seeing it in my head. Like,
well, yeah,
underwater.
I should have that written out for you, but I don't. Ray came up with the name.
Okay, and so. And you are, I believe you're wearing a Ray Charles hoodie? Is that Ray Charles or no?
You mean Ray Troll?
Troll, sorry. Yeah.
No, this was designed by a woman. This is a United Fishermen of Alaska. They come out with a thing every year.
Oh, cool. So. It's awesome. It's there's four ships, mm-hmm. I believe, and a bunch of fish underneath, mm-hmm. just giving context.
Yeah, that's a good one. But, you know, in closing here, you know, I really want to make the point that, you know, for a museum to be significant, it's got to be a part of the community. It's got to be fed by the community, and it's got to be relevant. And I really think that ours is. I think that, you know... I've really been excited about all the projects. The totem poles that we have are world class. The reclamated mass, unbelievable. So I think it's important to realize that we don't just have the history, but we've actually got the wherewithal to display and to attract these kinds of things that are. It's not just some little ho-dunk place. I mean, this is really significant artifacts that we have, and they help us encapsulate a wonderful, wonderful history that we have here in Rango.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And let's just talk about the celebration. It is mm-hmm. Monday, October 14th, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it starts at 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
What else can you say about it?
Well, we're going to have a potluck. So if anyone in town wants to bring something, we'd really appreciate it. And we're going to have some champagne there and wine. And we're going to have a toast for the the museum anniversary. I think we're going to have the mayor there and the city manager, and there's going to be some other speakers. But you know, our little group is dispersed because we didn't get to go out. But Anachinko is going to come to town, and I'll have a few things to say. But there'll be a few things. It's going to be short, you know, a couple hours, but I think it's going to be interesting and significant. And we're going to appeal to the town to become members and to support the museum. And also, we're going to need new board members. So we're hoping that out of this comes people that have this, also have this interest and desire. And
yeah. So that, again, is at 6 p.m. Monday, October 14th at the Nolan Center.
That's right.
Gig, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. It's been really fascinating and interesting to hear all of it. So that was Gig Decker, who spoke about shipwrecks, diving, deep sea diving, shipwrecks, and the celebration, the 20th anniversary of the Nolan Center. We are going to hop on into World Cafe.